Good morning, Bodhisattvas. Just another day. I hope everybody's well, well rested, ready for today. And what a wonderful talk last evening by Arshu So. Try it sometime. Not so easy to give a way-seeking mind talk, to figure out how to sum up your whole life of practice in, you know, 30 minutes worth of words, and in the doing of it, to be honest and unguarded. Not so easy to do. So when someone manages to do this with as much eloquence and heart as Tracy did last night, you are deeply amazed and impressed. What a brave heart Arshu So has. And I, like you, I was really inspired by her talk, and probably also you are like me in that you could see yourself somehow in her story, in her life, and you could understand better, as I understood better, why I'm here, and why all this matters so much to us, even though there's nothing to it at all. So the other day, a couple days ago, I was urging all of us to be serious about our session and to practice as diligently and devotedly as we can. And of course, you already know this, but I will confess that when I say stuff like that, I'm really talking to myself, right? I'm trying to get myself to be serious just as much as I'm talking to you, because I want to practice in this session with as much seriousness as I can muster so that I can realize something I have never realized before. So to that end, I suggested a lot of things about posture, maybe you remember, especially about the mudra. I talked a little bit about breathing, paying attention all the time. And I even suggested something I don't think I ever did before, that you chant the four vows silently to yourself before each period of zazen. And a few of you have told me that you've been doing this and that it's really good. So I'm glad. I didn't know if it would be any good. I have a few more suggestions today, just in case you want to take them up. First, practice with your eyes. We don't think about our eyes, you know. Neil thinks about our eyes, but most of us don't think about our eyes. And practicing with your eyes means don't look around. Just look at what happens to be right in front of you. And especially don't look at other people and don't make eye contact with other people. I know that we are really friendly people and our practice is friendly, but in Sesshin, being friendly means not looking at other people and not making eye contact. And it means not looking around at all. We've often mentioned this famous Buddhist word, ashrava, which means outflows. Sometimes they call it leaking. And it has to do with the effort to develop shamatha, concentration, that we were talking about the other day. When we develop concentration, what we want to do is not have any leaks, because when we have leaks, it's hard to develop concentration. And that means to collect ourselves right here in the body and mind, not to leak out energy as we usually do in ordinary life, squirting it all over the place with all of our mind going here and going there and looking there and thinking this and thinking that. And of all the guilty parties, the eyes are the big guilty party. They're the biggest leakers of all, because they're so curious, they're so grabby, looking everywhere, want to see stuff, you know. And then, of course, everything you see, you start thinking about it. Why is she wearing that? What is she thinking? Why does she walk like that? Why is the sky blue, you know? The eyes are curious, grabby. They want to see stuff everywhere, and they have opinions about everything. Not the mind, not the eyes, but the mind talking to the eyes have opinions about everything. And this is very, very distracting. So it's really good to practice paying close attention to your eyes when you're walking, when you're standing, when you're sitting, and looking just at what's in front of you without grabbing anything. So that's something to learn how to do, to let your eyes be soft and receptive, not aggressive and grabby. Maybe by now you could even understand what that means. Ordinarily, this would be like Greek. You know, what is he talking about? But you understand, right? Don't let your eyes be grabby. Let them be soft. Let them be receptive. Even when you're on the beach, look at what's in front of you. Don't look here and there. Let the world reveal itself to you as it will. Don't go chasing after it, because you'll never catch up to it that way. Practice with your body also, with your whole body. Make your body quiet. And your body becomes quiet when you bring awareness to it, just the way your breath, when you bring awareness to your breath, becomes quiet. Your whole body becomes quiet when you bring awareness to it. And then you're balancing your body, not just the thoughts in your head that compel your attention, but your whole body. And when you move, pay attention to how you're moving. Try to move with a little less fuss and a little less unconsciousness. Pay attention to your feet. Pay attention to your hands as they take something from the food buffet and put it on the plate as they pick up a fork. Don't be fussy or precious about this, because this would be easy to be very fussy and precious and self-conscious about this. Just in a simple way, you know, be there. And what happens when you try to do this is you notice with some great shock how much you are not there and have not been there, like your whole life. You start noticing, oh my God, how's that possible? Where have I been? Mostly somewhere in the clouds with your mind wandering here and there. You don't even know where. Most of the time we're thinking, we don't even know what we're thinking. Although maybe it's only me. Maybe I'm the only one. Maybe I'm just talking about myself, right? I may be the only one like this. But I doubt it. I doubt it. It's possible. Anyway, whether you're like this or not, do make your best effort to be there as completely as you can and as often as you can. When you forget, just in the next moment, jump back on, because you'll still be there. Do this on your cushion, of course. You're already doing it on your cushion, but do it more off the cushion, too. So there's really not that much difference between the cushion and not the cushion. And above all, just in case there's any little talking going on, you know, little side comments among friends, don't do it. A lot of us, you know, we have a very chummy, old-fashioned, comfortable group together. We really love each other, and we know each other so well, and we can't help it but look and smile and say something. I mean, we're not uptight Zen people. We're not religious fanatics. This is easygoing. So naturally, just a little comment here and there, a little word here and there is okay, but in session, it's not okay. Let's not do it. Because it's leaking. It's dissipating concentration. Maybe, and I fully understand, there may be some of you who think, you know what, I already concentrated enough. 30, 40 years, it's enough. I'm just relaxing. I'm being casual, I'm being friendly, I don't need to worry about this. And I grant you, this may be true for you. It may be true for you. But it's not good for other people. That's the problem. There are a lot of people in this session, and I happen to be one of them, who are depending on the power of real concentration. And when there's these little casual moments around, it makes us leaky too. And you might say, well, deal with it. Yes, we should deal with it. We are dealing with it. We should deal with it. And we're able to deal with it. But why make a problem for us after all? You know? Why do that to us? Why don't you help us out instead? And it might help you out too. So please, I'm asking all of us to be very careful with the silence and everything else. All the forms of Zen practice, the whole arrangement, is such a skillful creation by our ancestors. Every little detail is for the purpose of enhancing and increasing our concentration. That's why we don't have to figure out how to walk in the room. We know how to walk in there. We don't have to figure out how to get on our cushion. We know how to get it. All of it is set up to enhance our concentration, to strengthen our concentration. So let's all work with that, not against it. And the other thing is, this has been true, but I don't know we ever said it exactly, but a lot of us are here with our partners. Right? There's actually several of us here with our partners. And it's such a beautiful thing, really, that we have a sangha in which there are so many couples practicing together. It's quite beautiful. But it might be a little hard to live together in your little room and not talk. But try it. Do your best to minimize talk, to live differently together in sesshin than you do at home. And maybe you're already doing this. I hope you are. But if you're not, try it. And it will strengthen your concentration for when you're outside the room. And that will be a great benefit to everyone. But even if we did all this stuff like absolutely perfectly, which probably we won't, but even if we did it really, really well, there would still be a whole lot of talking in the sesshin because we have so many teachers. And people want to talk to the teachers, which is, on the whole, a good thing. I think we have some limiting rule. Otherwise, you could probably, like, never go to Zazen. Just see one teacher after the other, and then when you saw them all, start again at the beginning. You wouldn't have to go to any Zazen. And that would be one way of doing sesshin. But I think we have figured it out, some way of, you know, saying, I think something like, only see three teachers, that would be enough. Three would be enough. In normal, this is, we practice abnormal Soto Zen, but in normal Soto Zen, there's not this much talking, not nearly this much talking. Usually, during sesshin, you know, when I was a young Zen student, I would go to sesshin, one dokusan, for 7-day sesshin, once you'd go to visit the teacher. So there wasn't really too much talking at all. And so there was a lot of silence. Each person had a lot of silence. In Rinzai Zen, with koan study, they actually have tons of dokusan. You might go to dokusan 3 times a day or more. But the dokusan is very quick, maybe 30 seconds, literally, maybe a minute or two. A long one, 5 minutes, you know, and you're out. Because you're only there for the koan, that's it. In, out, quick. In and out, burger. in our practice of everyday Zen, and not only in everyday Zen, but in Soto Zen in general, and at the San Francisco Zen Center, I think it's the same. We think that the practice is not just on the cushion, but the practice is our living. So the meetings aren't 30 seconds long, they're longer. But I hope that we can practice silence, even in these conversations. Without being too formal about it, I think we can just go in and get to the heart of the matter. What's really important? What's the pith of it? Without a lot of casual talk and without a lot of storytelling and all of that. In other words, without too much leaking, we can have a practice meeting focused. Then some of you are on the Doan Ryo, and what a blessing to be able to extend your practice and share it with the whole Sangha, practicing with the han and the bells and the chanting, holding a stick of incense, tending the altar. It is a tremendous privilege to be able to share your spirit with the Sangha and to feel the presence of the whole Sangha, not only those of us here in Sesshin and online in Sesshin, but the whole Sangha, meaning all the sentient beings in all the universes, to feel their presence when you invite the bell, when you tap the drum. Inviting the bell is a wonderful phrase Thich Nhat Hanh taught us, to treat the bell with respect as if it were itself a Sangha member. In the Mokugyo and the beater were a Sangha member, and the han and the mallet are Sangha members. And then we're chanting. And chanting also is a device for increasing concentration. We chant from the belly, chant with the whole body reverberating. And Suzuki Roshi taught us to chant with our ears, meaning listen as you chant, so that your voice blends with all the other voices, and so that's just one voice chanting, the whole room is chanting. And chanting strengthens our faith and concentration. And sometimes in the chanting, you find something really powerful. Maybe you've felt that. Sometimes when you're chanting, a word goes in, all the way in. And for the rest of your life, you never forget it. And you understand beyond understanding. Probably you all know what I mean. One last thing, if you want a little more help concentrating on the breath, you could practice with the four words that I have suggested before during session, and some of you know them, and people always get mixed up which were the words, or they make their own, or they get them out of order, and I don't even know what they are myself, because I probably say them one way one time and another way the other time. It doesn't matter that much. But I think the way that I usually say it is, on the exhale, breathe in, and on the exhale, deep. Next breath, slow. Next breath, soft. Next breath, quiet. And just repeating, deep, slow, soft, and quiet. And if you focus your mind on those words and put them in your belly when you exhale, it can help. If you want to take that up, it can help you to stay with the breath if the breath is not, if you're not yet developing the breath. You can stay with the breath better that way, possibly. And that helps to keep your mind balanced, so there's not too much thinking. And when there is some thinking, it can be clear. And the point of all this in terms of what we've been talking about for the last, whatever it's been, 6 or 8 weeks or however long it's been, is that you can't really get any good out of all this stuff that Ashvaghosa is saying if your mind is not illuminated, if you don't have a bright interior. Ashvaghosa's words just go over the top of your head, and they really are not useful at all. It's just a lot of talking. It's necessary to develop focus and concentration in order to really appreciate this teaching. And your focus and your concentration has to be intense. Doesn't have to be frantic or desperate, but intense. When the mind is quiet, it expands. The quiet mind, the focused mind, is way bigger, and it goes beyond itself. It lights up, and then insight becomes possible. So please, let's all of us do our best so that we can awaken together. Part 3, Chapter 3 of Ashvaghosa. Because we finished Chapter 2 the other day. Now we're on Chapter 3. This is still Part 3. I think maybe this might be the end, this chapter of Part 3. Anyway, types of aspiration for enlightenment. 3 types. Aspiration through perfect faith, aspiration through understanding and deeds, and aspiration through insight. Here's what Ashvaghosa says about aspiration through perfect faith. He says, a bodhisattva should have a real understanding and appreciation for cause and effect. You know, what you do matters. Pay attention to what you do, because everything matters. And so, practice precepts carefully. The bodhisattva should also be devoted to sangha and teachers and practice with respect, with diligence, with devotion. And they should cultivate 3 kinds of minds, 3 kinds of mind. Straightforward mind, which is a phrase that's often used in Zen, straightforward mind. It sort of means what we think it means colloquially, straightforward mind. Suzuki Roshi, I think, called it sincerity. But here, it means more specifically a mind that is in tune with or focused on suchness. That's the first kind of mind that should be developed. The second kind of mind is profound mind. And that's a mind that appreciates the endlessness of the path. And the third mind is compassionate mind. A mind that deeply, deeply wishes to benefit beings. Then he says that this kind of bodhisattva should also practice 4 kinds of expedient means. First, they should meditate on the unborn nature of everything, not the inborn nature. Autocorrect only understands inborn nature, doesn't understand unborn nature. This is not inborn nature, this is unborn nature. First, they should meditate on the unborn nature of everything, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the fact that the effects of karma will never, forever, and ever, ever, never be lost. And that's why we take such care with all beings to be kind and compassionate. So they should first develop that mind. Second, they should develop a sense of shame and repentance. Because living in the phenomenal world, as phenomenal beings, they will definitely break precepts and hurt people. And so when they do that, they should know how to truly be ashamed and repent and make amends and try to correct the behavior. And third, they should pay homage to the Buddhas. And they should pray to the Buddhas for awakening and compassion. And they should always have a great respect for the Triple Treasure. And the last expedient means, fourth, is the vow to save all beings. So that the selfless nature of the practice is clear. In other words, it's not altruism, it's just the recognition that there is no other way. Any other way would be impossible. The only way to practice is for and with everyone. So that's the teaching that Ashvaghosa gives about the first kind of aspiration through perfection of faith. The second kind of aspiration is aspiration through understanding and good deeds. And his discussion here is quite short because he knows that what he's referring to, we know very, very well, and we've read about it in many other places. So he only says a little bit about it, he just refers to it. And this is the practice of the six paramitas. We wrote a whole book about it. So this is, you know, giving, morality, patient forbearance, joyful energy, meditation, and prajna, wisdom. The wisdom that cognizes emptiness. We practice the six paramitas, and that's the way we develop the aspiration through understanding and good deeds. The third aspiration is aspiration through insight. And Ashvaghosa begins his discussion of this one by saying that the bodhisattva should realize suchness. He just sort of says that in the beginning. Boom. The bodhisattva should realize suchness. And then, of course, he immediately points out that there's no such thing as suchness. There's no object, idea, or state that the word suchness would neatly fit on. And yet, since we're talking, we need a word, even though it is, strictly speaking, a non-word. And he doesn't even entertain the idea that there would be any method for realizing suchness. He just says, realize suchness. Because I guess suchness would be kind of by definition, since there's nothing to it, it would be beyond methods. And it would be beyond realization. But he does say that the bodhisattva who realizes suchness can, in an instant of thought, go to all worlds, and in those worlds, honor the various Buddhas there and ask them to turn the Dharma wheel. Also, it's worth reflecting on the fact that in delineating three types of aspiration, he just says there's these three types. He's not saying whether you get to pick one and ignore the other two, or pick two out of three. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say whether you need all of them. First, you start with the first one, the second one, the third one. He doesn't say that either. But if he does mean that, it's the first one, then the second one, then the third one, then I think you could appreciate that, okay, well, maybe if I were to really appreciate cause and effect and practice precepts and be devoted and practice six paramitas and develop them, then yeah, boom, maybe suchness would just pop up. And that would be a very natural thing. And then, yeah, I would be everywhere all the time, in every moment. And that saves a lot of airfare. And all the wear and tear on the body, all the jet lag and everything. You don't have the jet lag when you're everywhere in every moment. Then he says, this kind of bodhisattva does not rely on words. And this phrase, not rely on words, is exactly the phrase that Bodhidharma uses when he first defines Chan in China. He says, Chan is a special teaching pointing directly to the mind and not relying on words. And this sounds like a rejection of words, like we should find some silence outside of words. But I don't think it's a rejection of words per se, as we've noted so many times in Dogen's writing. Now, as I said in the beginning, this is Sesshin, so we're practicing letting go of words and thoughts. But this is a provisional practice for Sesshin, and there's a reason for it, as we said. But not relying on words means not sticking to words, not literalizing words, as if words referred to fixed objects or ideas that actually existed. I have had the thought that maybe what we're all doing, you know, in this whole life is coming up with the definition of two words. The two words of our name. People might have another word, maybe they have a middle name or two. But basically, the whole life is defining these two words. John Doe, Mary Doe. What does that mean? This whole life. You live a whole life, and at the end of your life, now we know what these words mean. But even then, there's more. So you can think of that, right? But every word is the same. Every word is like that. It has a whole life. So much living behind every word. Think of all the mouths that have said these words before you. They're all there, right, in the words. And the meaning of each word is therefore infinite. When you know this, you will use words differently. Bodhisattvas who aspire to enlightenment through insight know this. And so when they read the sutras, they understand the meaning, not just the words, as usually understood. And that's why they can expound the sutras in all kinds of different ways that may look like they have nothing to do with the sutras. But that's because they know the real meaning. And they expound according to the person and the situation, each time uniquely. Actually, as I often like to point out, the Buddha did this in the beginning. Every single teaching of the Buddha was in a particular situation with a particular person in mind. But people didn't seem to notice that particularly. But bodhisattvas notice it. And they know. So not relying on words is not a rejection of words, but it's a certain kind of understanding of words, an understanding of words, what words actually are, and what they're for. Bodhisattvas of this type, Ashvaghosa goes on, develop three subtle minds. You're keeping track of all this, right? Three subtle minds. I will now tell you what they are, in case you forgot. They are, first, true mind. True mind is a mind that does not discriminate. And in this case, what that means is discriminating without believing in the discriminations. Seeing that the discriminations, convincing as they might appear at first, are actually phantoms. They're whispers of oneness. In other words, bodhisattvas see the whole world as their own mind, and their own mind as the whole world. They don't see that there's a world out over there and a mind over here. They don't see that there's a person over here, an atomized person over here and a world over there. They see, as an early sutra says, There's no inside, no outside, and no in between. So that's the first subtle mind, true mind. The second subtle mind is expedient means, upaya, which means that the bodhisattva has the freedom and the joy of seeing everything always as dharma and using everything to awaken beings and bring them comfort. And the third subtle mind is the mind, and this is a direct quote now, the mind of karma in the storehouse consciousness that appears and disappears in mysterious ways. That's the third kind of subtle mind. It's kind of interesting one, right? What does it mean? Well, it sounds very similar to me and what Dogen said, and I think I may have mentioned this already this week. The world advances and confirms the self rather than the self advancing and confronting the world. In other words, this kind of bodhisattva knows that the whole mysterious turning of the universe, all of its comings and goings, teaches us and takes care of us. And that's why I always say there couldn't possibly be any teachers of Zen or even really any teachers of Buddhism, as if Zen or Buddhism were a subject that someone had mastered and now they're going to teach it to you. No one masters Zen. There are no Zen masters. The turning of the world moment by moment brings us all of us together as a universal community, everything we need on each occasion, and then it's gone, and there's a new occasion, moment after moment. So this is the kind of bodhisattva that really knows that. And so they live in the world with compassion and with the effort to help bring all beings to awakening without any stress or strain, but instead constant gratefulness and amazement. And this, Ashvaghosa says, is what we call all-embracing knowledge. Then up pops up our questioner. Remember our questioner who always says, wait a minute, you know, that doesn't make sense. You just said this and now you're saying that. So this questioner pops up, and I'll quote you the exchange here. The questioner pops up and says, since space is infinite, worlds are infinite. Since worlds are infinite, beings are infinite. Since beings are infinite, the variety of their mentalities must also be infinite. The objects of the senses and of the mind must therefore be limitless, and it is difficult to know and understand them all. If ignorance is destroyed, there will be no thoughts in the mind. How then can a bodhisattva have all-embracing knowledge? Good question. And here's the answer. All objects are originally one mind and are beyond thought discrimination. Because unenlightened people perceive objects in their illusion, they impose limitations on their mind, which is unlimited, actually. But we impose limitations. Since they erroneously develop these thought determinations which do not correspond to reality, they are unable to reach any inclusive comprehension. The Buddha Tathagatas are free from all perverse views and thoughts. There are no corners into which their comprehension does not penetrate. Their mind is true and real. Therefore, it is no other than the essential nature of all things. The Buddhas, because of their very nature, can shed light on all objects conceived in illusion. They are endowed with an influence of great wisdom that functions as the application of innumerable expedient means, accommodating themselves to the capacity of understanding of various sentient beings. They can reveal to them the manifold meanings of the doctrine. And that's why we call the people who have this understanding, all-embracing knowledge. And that's pretty much the end of that chapter. That's good. We don't have to know everything on Wikipedia. Okay, I close with another passage from Suzuki Roshi. And I could find out, you know, Juryo probably knows the answer to this, but I'm not sure, but it's possible. It seems likely, actually, that these words that Suzuki Roshi says that I'm about to read for you, he said them when he knew he was going to die. I think he knew he was going to die maybe about a year or so before he passed. And I think maybe he was thinking about the Zen Center and how the students at the Zen Center would memorialize him after he died. In his temple in Rinzai-in, in Japan, in the back of the temple, there's a cemetery for all the abbots. And there are many, many impressive stupas for each abbot. And Suzuki Roshi could have said, well, let's start a cemetery like that here. But he thought, no, we don't want to do that. This is America. We don't want to do that here. I don't think I want a stupa here, he thought. And as you know, there is not a stupa for Suzuki Roshi at Tassajara. There is a stone, big stone there. And just a few weeks ago, I listened to a podcast with David Chadwick and Ed Brown, David, who has just passed, and Ed Brown. And they were talking about the old days at Tassajara, and David told a story about how Suzuki Roshi saw that stone one day. You probably heard it too, that podcast, yeah. And he said, I like that stone. I want that stone for my gravestone. And they lost track of it, got covered up with mud and everything, and they somehow found it later after he died, and they dug it out, and they managed to get it all the way up to the Hogback. David says that it was Dan Welsh who got it up there, and then Dan and Reb Anderson set the stone for Suzuki Roshi. Anyway, this is what Suzuki Roshi is saying here. Nanyo Eichu was a famous teacher and a very good Zen master. He was one of the disciples of the sixth ancestor of Zen in China. He didn't have many descendants, so we don't know much about him. When Nanyo was dying, the emperor asked what kind of tombstone they should make for him, and Nanyo told the emperor's messenger, "Ask my disciples." So before a tombstone was made for him, the disciples had a committee meeting, a discussion about this. And one of them said, "I think it should be as big as the whole country. I think this tombstone should cover, you know, all of China, south of Shou and north of Tan." And another one said, "No, that would be too small. It should cover the entire world." And that's Suzuki Roshi quoting him. And then he says, but I would rather say, as their teacher Nanyo himself said when he was asked, any stone will be good enough. Even a small stone is good enough for me. So which do you like, the whole world or a small stone? Nanyo said, "I prefer a small stone that we can carry or move." If you know what a small stone is, you know that it is you yourself and that it covers everything. But if you think that you need to see the entire universe in order to see yourself, you will be lost. You need one small room for yourself. And this is very true. When you can really find yourself in a small room, then there is you yourself. And the whole universe is there. And the whole universe makes sense to you. Without your one small room, the whole universe doesn't make any sense. So what you need now is a small room. And what you need after your death is a small stone. And that's the actual reality. And it's true for everyone. So I don't talk about the whole universe or some mysterious experience, but just about finding yourself in a small room or in the strict practice of formal zazen where we say, you should cross your legs in just this way. Under this kind of limitation, you will find yourself. Your real self is there. But because you discuss whether this room is good or bad, big or small, you're going to lose the real room. Before you discuss, and before you are caught by discrimination or thinking mind, it is already your own real room. So find true joy under this limitation. And that's the way you realize the whole universe. There is no other way for us to get an approach to the whole universe. When you exist right here, the whole universe makes sense to you before you think about it. It is important to give up your foolish discrimination, your foolish ideas of freedom. This is the way of practice. So those are Suzuki Roshi's words. I thank Tracy again for her wonderful talk, and we're lucky we get to hear from her again tomorrow evening. And thanks to everyone here for your practice. Let's keep on.